let's be fair. There have been Democrats in the isolationist camp, but they have been relatively few and far between. And so far, they have not attained great positions of leadership. And I am proud of the fact that this administration does not have the support of the isolationist press. For about a half a century, I've been accustomed to naming names. I mean specifically, to take the glaring examples, the McCormick, Patterson, Gannett, and Hearst Press. You know, the American people have gone through great national debates in the recent critical years. They were soul-searching debates. They reached from every city to every village and every home. We have debated our principles, our determination to aid those fighting for freedom. Obviously, we could have come to terms with Hitler. We could have accepted a minor role in his totalitarian world. We rejected that. We could have compromised with Japan and bargained for a place in the Japanese-dominated Asia, the Japanese-dominated Pacific, by selling out the heart, blood of the Chinese people, and we rejected that. As I look back, I'm more and more certain that the decision not to bargain with the tyrant rose from the hearts and souls and sinews of the American people. They faced reality. They appraised reality. They knew what freedom meant. The power which this nation has attained, the political, the economic, the military, and above all, the moral power, has brought to us the responsibility and with it the opportunity for leadership in the community of nations. It is our best interest, in the name of peace and humanity, this nation cannot, must not, and will not shirk that responsibility. Now there are some who hope to see a structure of peace, a structure of police peace completely set up immediately, with all of the apartments assigned to everybody's satisfaction, with the telephones in and the plumbing complete, the heating system, the electric ice boxes, all functioning perfectly, all furnished with linen and silver, and with the rent prepaid. The United Nations have not yet produced such a comfortable dwelling place. But we have achieved a very practical expression of a common purpose on the part of four great nations who are now united to wage this war, that they will embark together after the war on a greater and more difficult enterprise. And the enterprise of waging peace. We will embark on it with all the peace-loving nations of the world, large and small. And our objective, as I stated 10 days ago, is to complete the organization of the United Nations without delay, before hostilities actually cease. You know, peace, like war, can succeed only when there's a will to enforce it and where there is available power to enforce it. The Council of the League of Nations, of the United Nations, must have the power to act quickly and decisively to keep the peace by force if necessary. I live in a small town, and I always think in small town terms. But this goes for small towns as well as big towns. A policeman would not be a very effective policeman if, when he saw a felon break into a house, he had to go to the town hall and call a town meeting to issue a warrant before the felon could be arrested. So to mind, simple mind, it is clear that if the World Organization is to have any reality at all, our American representative must be endowed in advance by the people themselves, by constitutional means, through their representatives in Congress, with authority to act. If we do not catch the international felon when we have our hands on him, if we let him get away with his loot because the town council has not passed an ordinance authorizing his arrest, then we are not doing our share to prevent another world war. I think, and I've had some experience, that the people of this nation want their government to work. They want their government to act and not merely talk whenever and wherever there's a threat to world peace. Now, it's obvious that we cannot attain our great objectives by ourselves. Never again, after cooperating with other nations in a world war to save our way of life, can we wash our hands of maintaining the peace for which we fought. The Dumbarton Oaks Conference didn't spring up overnight. It was called by Secretary Hull and me after years of thought, discussion, preparation, consultation with our allies. Our State Department did a grand job in preparing for the conference and leading it to a successful termination. It was just another chapter in the long process of cooperation with other peace-loving nations, beginning with the Atlantic Charter, not a long time ago, and continuing through conferences at Casablanca and Moscow and Cairo and Tehran and Quebec and Washington. It is my profound conviction that the American people as a whole have a very real understanding of these things. The American people know that Cordell Hull and I are thoroughly conversant with the Constitution of the United States and know that we cannot commit this nation to any secret treaty or any secret guarantees that are in violation of that Constitution. After my return from Tehran, I stated officially that no secret commitments had been made. The issue, then, is between my veracity and the continuing assertions of those who have no responsibility in the foreign field, or perhaps I should say a field foreign to them. No president of the United States, been quite a lot of them too, can or could have made the American contribution to preserve the peace without the constant, alert, and conscious collaboration of the American people. Only the determination of the people to use the machinery gives worth to the machinery. Remember that. We believe that the American people already made up their minds on this great issue, and this administration has been able to press forward confidently with its plan. We are seeking to avert and avoid war. The very fact that we are now at work on the organization of peace proves that the great nations are committed to trust each other. Put this proposition any way you want. It's bound to come out the same way. We either work with the other great nations, or we might someday have to fight them. And I'm against that. The kind of world order which we, the peace-loving nations, must achieve, must depend essentially on friendly human relations, on acquaintance, on tolerance, on unassailable sincerity, and goodwill and good faith. We've achieved that relationship to a very remarkable degree in our dealings with our allies in this war, as I think the events of the war have proved. It is a new thing in human history for allies to work together, as we have done, so closely, so harmoniously, so effectively in the fighting of a war, and at the same time in the building of a peace. If we fail to maintain that relationship in the peace, if we fail to expand it and strengthen it, then there will be no lasting peace. I digress for a moment. As to Germany, that tragic nation, which has sown the wind and is now reaping the whirlwind, we and our allies are entirely agreed that we shall not bargain with the Nazi conspirators in control, open or secret, of the instruments of government. We shall not leave them a single element of military power or a potential military power. But I should be false to the very foundations of my religious and political convictions if I should ever relinquish the hope or even the faith that in all peoples, without exception, there lives some instinct for truth, some attraction toward justice, some passion for peace. Buried as they may be in the German case under a brutal regime, we bring no charge against the German race as such, for we cannot believe that God has eternally condemned any race of humanity. We know in our own land, in the United States of America, how many good men and women of German ancestry have proved loyal, freedom-loving, and peace-loving citizens. But there is going to be a stern punishment for all those in Germany directly responsible for this agony of mankind. The German people are not going to be enslaved. Why? Because the United Nations do not traffic in human slavery. But it will be necessary for them to earn their way back. Earn their way back into the fellowship of peace-loving and law-abiding nations. And in their climb up that steep road, we shall certainly see to it that they are not encumbered by having to carry guns. We hope they will be relieved of that burden forever. No, the task ahead of us will not be easy. Indeed, it will be difficult, complex, as any task has ever faced any American administration. I will not say to you now or ever that we of the Democratic Party know all the answers. I am certain for myself that I do not know how all the unforeseeable difficulties can be met. What I can say to you is this, that I have unlimited faith that the task can be done. And that faith is based on knowledge. Knowledge gained in the arduous, practical, and continuing experience of these past eventful years. And so I speak to the present generation of Americans with a reverent participation in its sorrows and in its hopes. No generation has undergone a greater test or has met that test with greater heroism and I think greater wisdom. And no generation has had a more exalted mission. For this generation must act not only for itself, but as a trustee for all of those who fell in the last war, a part of their mission unfulfilled. It must act also for all those who paid the supreme price in this war, lest their mission, too, be betrayed. And finally, it must act for the generations to come that must be granted a heritage of peace. I do not exaggerate that mission. We are not fighting for, and we shall not obtain, a utopia. Indeed, in our own land, the work to be done is never finished. We have yet to realize the full and equal enjoyment of our freedom. So in embarking on the building of a world fellowship, we have set ourselves a long and arduous task, a task that will challenge our patience, our intelligence, our imagination, as well as our faith. That task, my friends, calls for the judgment of a seasoned and mature people. This, I think, the American people have become. We shall not again be thwarted in our will to live as a mature nation, confronting limitless horizons. We shall bear our full responsibility, exercise our full influence, and bring our full help and encouragement to all who aspire to peace and freedom. We now are, and we shall continue to be, strong brothers. Strong brothers in the family of mankind, family of the children of God.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard an address by the President of the United States before the membership of the Foreign Policy Association. His address was the climax of a long and busy day in America's largest city. Mr. Roosevelt spoke from the Grand Ballroom of the Waldorf Astoria in New York.
Time for the presentation of the Honorable Franklin D. Roosevelt, Democratic presidential nominee, was purchased by the Democratic National Committee and paid for by money received from its special radio fund.